So you're okay with money being left on the table?
Yeah, I think there are other situations where people made quite some money with my music that bother me a little bit more. Like, for example, a remix I did for Diplo that wasn't paid at all. Sure. I was like, cool, like, what do I get? They're like, yeah, you don't get anything. You can make a remix for Diplo, official remix. Said I, okay, cool. And later was licensed in a Coca-Cola commercial worldwide for two things where the entire commercial built on my music. And like, he got everything and I got zero because I didn't have any credits. I just gave away the rights. So this is more where I'm like, okay.
So I read somewhere that you actually did work with a major label for a little time. I'm curious why and what that experience was like.
Oh, man.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.
Why? Good question.
What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Third edition is out now everywhere in all formats, audiobook, ebook, hardcover, however you like to consume books. You can find the book where you find books. Today, my guest is Chris Boutonneur, better known as The Fat Rat. That's his artist project name, producer project name, and gamer handle, as you'll learn. He's an electronic artist that has billions and billions, with a B, billions of streams across all platforms. Over 29 billion, again, with a B, billion views on YouTube, and, you know, millions of views on TikTok, hundreds of millions of views on TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, all the platforms, and he's in this very specific niche of kind of electronic music. He calls it kind of euphoric progressive house to trap and melodic glitch hop. But it's, you know, heavy influence of video game music. The gamer community really latched on to his music. And he's also had sync placements in video games like Dota 2, Rocket League, Rolling Sky, Game for Peace. He had a major placement in a Coca-Cola commercial with Diplo, which he discusses. He has done remixes for Chris Brown and Foster the People. And, you know, we talk about his journey primarily over the last kind of 10 years or so of how he has done this all independently, you know, and he owns his music and he releases independently. And we dig into all of it. We talk about how he's done all of this and where all of the success came from, his journey, and how he's evolved through this. So, you know, whether you're into game music, gamer music, electronic music or not, I'm not. I don't know this community very well, but it was very interesting and very fascinating. He's a very smart guy. And we went on a few tangents, and I learned a ton, and it was just very inspiring. So I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. You can find The Fat Rat everywhere on Instagram, TikTok, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube. On YouTube, he has over 6 million subscribers on YouTube, too, you know. You can find all of us that make the show happen at Ari's Take on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, of course, X or Threads. You can find me at Ari Herstand on Instagram. Visit ariestake.com. Get on the email list. That's where you're going to get the most up-to-date relevant information. We let you know when new episodes are out and other stuff that you need to know. Just go to ariestake.com. Get on the email list. And if you could just pause right now and leave us a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or however you listen to this, if it's YouTube, give us a thumbs up, subscribe, hit the follow button, all of that. You want us to keep doing these, show up in your feed. All right, let's kick into the show. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Where are you based? I sense a little accent coming through, and I'm curious kind of your origins.
Oh, I'm based in Cyprus now, but I'm from Germany. But I moved here about 2.5 years ago.
Nice. Cool. Why the shift to Cyprus? What brought you there?
Oh, a couple of reasons. I think the most important was that I would say the bureaucracy in Germany felt like it really kept me down. It's very much you want to do stuff and there are so many regulations that it gets really, really complicated. I think Germany is more made for big companies and being employed at big companies. If you want to be independent, if you want to do your own thing, it gets really complicated in Germany. And actually a lot of people are leaving now, like the people who are starting new ventures, they go somewhere else.
All right. Interesting. That's fascinating. Well, I want to take it back a bit because, you know, I see, you know, you have billions of streams. I believe I counted like saw somewhere you have like 29 billion collective views on YouTube. You have all of these followers on all the different platforms. It does. As I was looking around, it's like it's not just YouTube. You know, you have a significant following on all of them, TikTok and Spotify and everything. I want to go way back though. I would love to just hear a little bit of your journey of just kind of like how as an independent artist. You know, you got to this point and just kind of hear a little bit of the story of how you've found this success.
Yeah, initially I didn't plan to be an artist at all. And initially I was not. I was just a music producer producing for other artists.
Okay.
Like Max Martin, like those guys who are just in the studio, they're just making music, but they're not on stage and they're not in front of the camera. But the music industry was just so frustrating over time. So I did this for 10 years. I worked with great artists. I worked with Jason Derulo and Lupe Fiasco and Tove Lo and all those people in Los Angeles. The industry part, like the music has always been fun, but the industry part was very frustrating. So at one point I decided I would just put my own stuff on SoundCloud and see what happens. It was just electronic instrumental tracks. And that didn't blow up immediately, but some people discovered me and they asked me to do remixes. And so I did one remix for The Knox. That worked well. And then I did a remix for Foster the People and that really blew up.
And what year are we talking here? Are we started. Talking like, what year was that? Foster the People, so it was like, what, 2012, 20, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that was 2012, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. January 2012.
Yeah. All right. Sweet. Yeah, that was a moment. So the remix blew up. So that kind of put in, was that as the Fat Rat? Were you kind of credited as this remix?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I just started. So the Fat Rat is my gamer tag. It wasn't like a well thought out artist name. I simply uploaded three tracks to SoundCloud, used my gamer tag, and yeah, it was Foster the People, Don't Stop the Fat Rat remix, and that remix really blew up. And then I made one for Avicii Levels, and that really blew up. And back then, Hype Machine was a big thing. For those who remember it, it's still around, but I think it was very, very influential. Mm-hmm. So it was like charts for the music blogs, which were was the place where everybody was discovering music. And so the Foster the People remix hit number one on Hype Machine. The Levels remix hit number one on Hype Machine. And then throughout 2012, I had 10 remixes going into the top 10 on Hype Machine, consecutive remixes. So that's how it started.
And I would imagine around this time, because this just happened when all of the action was on Hype Machine. And for those who are listening who are not familiar with what Hype Machine was, it's essentially a blog aggregator. So when more blogs write about a song and there was they're writing about singles, essentially they were aggregated and categorized on Hype Machine and they would rank them. So the more blogs that wrote about one song, you'd get ranked higher up on the Hype Machine charts. And it was kind of that front page, the homepage of Hype Machine. You know, the top 10 around this time period, 2012, the entire industry was focusing on the Hype Machine charts. It was essentially kind of like you know, where the industry's at now with what's blowing up on TikTok. It was then, it was hype machine. It was all hype machine. And so, you know, all the managers, all the label A&R, everybody was kind of focusing on what was popping off on Hype Machine, because the blogs, the bloggers were the tastemakers of the time. And they were the ones that were kind of, you know, and if you got a big, if you got like one big blog article at this time period, that could turn into hundreds of thousands of SoundCloud streams in a few days, let alone, you know, a bunch where if you're charting number one on Hype Machine, I'm sure there was a ton of blogs that were writing about it. So that was translating into a lot of, at the time it was SoundCloud streams, which of course were not really paid. But I would imagine that you had a lot of industry interest at the time. Were there any labels that hit you up and you're like, hey, sign a deal with us and, like, you know, we'll make you a star?
Yeah. Well, not so much as an artist at that point, but I simply got remix requests, official remix requests then. And did some official remixes and started regretting it again, getting in touch with the music industry.
How did those remix, and I'm just curious of these deals, like when you're doing these remixes with these bigger artists, break down what these deals were. Were they paying you up front a good amount? Was it in advance? Were you getting back on royalties? Were you sharing in the copyright? Like, really break that deal down for me.
So there are two things. So the main thing that really bothered me, so I made an official remix, I think it was for Chris Brown. And the typical, like, the entire process was typical music industry. So they got in contact with me. They said, oh, we need this remix within 3 days, which is not a lot of time to make a proper remix.
Sure.
So I said,
and by they, you mean like the label, or was it his management? The label. Okay.
No, I think it was the label. It went through my management, so I don't even know exactly who was the person on the other side.
Okay.
So I did the remix within 3 days, send it over, and then you don't hear back for like 1 month or two.
Now, when they say we need this remix within 3 days, was it like they're going to pay you for that? Was this a job, or was this like you're going to make royalties? Okay. How much was it?
No, that was paid. So you get a payout. So that was like, $3,500, I think, if I remember correctly, US dollars. So it was a decent, I'm not going to complain about the pure money side, but here comes the part that really bothered me. That was all of a sudden, at some point I got, messages on Facebook back then and saying like, hey, I heard this Chris Brown remix. I didn't even know it came out. And they said, like, yeah, I saw it was released in UK, but I'm in the US. I would like to get it. Where can I get it? And I'm like, I don't even know that remix is out. Wow. So they just released it like randomly, but with like geo-blocking. So some people could buy it and some people could not. And some people could hear it and some people could not. And it was just so frustrating, because usually I would make it an event. Like, people were waiting for the remixes. And I already had hundred thousands of plays on SoundCloud for each song track that I uploaded.
Sure.
So there was really they really did a poor job in releasing it, because like they could have told me, I could have promoted it properly.
Sure.
And maybe like a worldwide release at one point would make sense. So everybody like, yeah, the remix is out, and people would start buying it and streaming it and stuff. But back then they would rather buy it on iTunes. But it was just so confusing. Like this is just typical thing. Like you have to deliver it in 3 days. Then you don't hear back for 2 months. At some point you get an agreement that you get to sign it. Yeah, you get the money. Sure. Cool. Mm-hmm, not complaining about that, but then you have this, like, it's like randomly released. You don't even know when it's released, and then it's just at some territories, and other territories it's not, and all those crazy things. And then of course it was like blocked everywhere. So it was like, then I got a copyright strike on my own SoundCloud for uploading it, and those kind of things, like the typical stuff that you would expect.
Right. So when was the time? So did you stop doing remixes, official remixes? And when you say, just to clarify, when you say an official remix, you mean that this was facilitated by the record label, where they gave you, you know, essentially they're paying you and hiring you to make this remix. Whereas what would you consider an unofficial remix, and the difference?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's the unofficial remixes where you, like, it's also called bootleg remixes, where you just take something and you remix it without, sort of without the artist's consent, which for a lot of artists was cool. For a lot of labels, they didn't. Sometimes they cared, sometimes they didn't. For example, but also they were like, the Foster the People remix I did, they requested the remix. I made the remix. They didn't pay me the money that I want to have, or also that my management want to have, because I was also somewhat established as a producer. So I didn't want to like devaluate my destroy my own prices, right? Sure. They wanted to pay, I think, like $500 at that time. So I said, no, I cannot do that, because otherwise I'm like, my prices will go down. But they agreed that I could unofficially put out the remix. So that would also be like an unofficial remix. It was like, okay, the band was happy, the label agreed, but it was never released officially through the record company.
Got it.
I don't know, hundreds, but millions and millions and millions of streams. So that would have been a very, very good investment from the label if they had bought the remix. But yeah, whatever.
Right. So yeah, I mean, and that was a different time of the industry too, when streaming wasn't really monetized. Everyone was just trying to drive traffic towards iTunes for the sales. SoundCloud, yes, they could block it, but it wasn't really monetized. YouTube was starting to become monetized, but it was really just ads. And so, you know, it's not like it is today, where there's more streamlined mechanisms for royalties and payment and all of that. But so did you realize at the time that, okay, you don't want to really do these official remixes and the headaches just isn't worth it? And how did you kind of transition to be the artist, the Fat Rat?
So first of all, what I did, I moved back to Germany from Los Angeles, and I was almost about like sort of quitting the music business. So I moved into a small village south of my hometown, which is really in the middle of nowhere, the complete opposite of Los Angeles. And so like, oh, what am I going to do with my life now? Because I had streaming income, like I had royalties that I could live off. So I could sort of almost retire on a very low level. But since we were living cheap, my wife and I was like, cool, this is enough. So I just played video games for a couple of months, and then that got really boring. And then I thought like, oh, so what am I going to do now? And they just thought, okay, just going to make music that I like. Yeah. So that was sort of the point where it was just, I just make some music that I like, put it out there. I don't know what's going to happen. And it was very bad in releasing it, like very unstructured releases. And in the beginning, so the first original that I put out, I didn't put it on the platforms, because I just put it on SoundCloud and YouTube, and it really started growing. The first song was Unity, which now has over 250 million plays on YouTube on my own channel. But I just uploaded it and didn't put it on Spotify, didn't put it on iTunes and stuff. And then people asked me, hey, I can find it on Spotify. So they were asking on Facebook, and I would write them back, oh, it's no problem, you can download it. And then I would explain how they can put it in their own Spotify, right? Because back then you could just download an MP3 and then inject it into your own Spotify. So I would explain it to the person that asked me. And then I had another question. And after half a year of answering questions and explaining people how they could download the MP3, I finally uploaded to Spotify. And the reason I didn't upload it was because everybody was saying, you don't make any money from streaming anyway. And also you don't make any money from sales. And and now it has... Actually, the song later made millions of streams. It's just going, not only millions of streams, but I think like millions of revenue. It's just going, still going and, crazy. And
for the record, you have and are making money from streaming and Spotify.
Yes. I think when you're independent, it's almost like, even if you're like 10 times smaller than me, it's very decent money.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're learning as you go. Now, when you say these songs took off, I mean, how did the songs take off? Did you have the Hype Machine action? Did you release it? Were blogs writing about it? Were you getting on like YouTube playlists, or what was making these your first releases on YouTube and SoundCloud take off?
So fortunately, I realized that things had changed, and the YouTube tastemakers were replacing the music blogs. So I sent my first self-release to a YouTube tastemaker, and they said, like, no, they're not interested. And I repeated that process like 10 times. And then finally I had someone who said, yeah, cool, we're going to upload it. But that definitely helped. So it was the Tasty Network was the name of the YouTube channel. They had, I don't know, maybe 400,000 subscribers or something, but they had very decent plays. They had like over 100,000 plays on every video they uploaded. And that they put it there. They said in the description that it's free to use for everybody, which I could allow people because I made the song. It was entirely my song. And then another channel called Xkaito picked it up. And that channel also gained like 100,000 plays. And it just kept growing from there. And for a few years, my songs were the top videos on those channels. So they really kept growing on those channels. Because the algorithm kicked in, it realized, okay, people like the song, so we're going to show it to more people. So that was really what started it.
What was the focus of these channels?
Electronic music.
Electronic music, got it. So, and was it? So, I know that kind of the gamer community has latched on a bit to your music. You are a gamer. You said that your gamer tag, it became your artist name. How does that happen? How did the gamer community latch on or find it? And when you say that this was like free to use for anyone on YouTube, what does that mean in practice?
So in practice, that means what we said, like the YouTube channel where I uploaded it, and I always said, hey, you can use the music as background music in your video, but please credit me, which means please say in the description, hey, we used the music Unity from the Fat Rat. And I sort of underestimated the impact at that time because so many channels had problem finding good music. Now there are way more music libraries with free to use music, but back then everybody was searching for music that they could use because the model, I think it has changed now, where you can have percentages, so you give away percentages, you can agree on percentages of the video that you give to somebody else. But back then you would use a music that was copyrighted and they would take your entire revenue of your video. And people would just use like 5 seconds as an outro and they would lose the entire revenue of a 15 minutes video because of those 5 seconds. So that was one reason, because my music, it really clicked with people, it really clicked with the gaming community. And it was, a lot of it was instrumental, so it was easily usable for intros and outros and background music as well. So a couple of factors came together.
Yeah.
And so it really spread. Like, it was like the standard outro song they still say today, like, was Xenogenesis. Like, every YouTube channel, like, every gaming channel had most of them had my music as outros.
So, got it. So, it was the YouTubers that were using your music were typically gamers or those that were kind of recording themselves playing a video game, and they'd use your music as the soundtrack of their channels or of those their videos, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, okay, and they're monetizing their videos, I would imagine. I mean, I think they're probably making some significant revenue. We know that YouTubers could make revenue, especially in the gamer community. Were you seeing any of that revenue at the time?
No. No.
Okay. Did that make you a little uncomfortable or frustrated, or was there any reason? No. Like, how were you making money?
No. No, I saw it as a promotion. And the thing is, like I said before,
promotion,
like,
for what?
Like, for my music.
But how were you making money, or like, what were you promoting? What was I guess the end game here? Like, is it like, how are you going to, if you weren't making money where you're getting all these millions of views and streams, like, what were you expecting to happen where this was going to promote something that you were going to be able to earn some revenue from?
So first of all, I didn't really think so too much about revenue at all in the beginning. Okay. I simply enjoyed making music and wanted people to listen to my music and be just have it out there. So it was almost, and I even made the songs open source. So I really wasn't thinking about money in the first place. So that was one thing. And then what I said is, hey, can you please credit me in the description? So people heard the music. They said like, oh, I like this. What is it? They found it in the description and they ended up on my channel or my Spotify and stuff like that.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. So you did see it actually working as a promotional tool where they found you and then they were watching videos on your YouTube channel, which then you could monetize, or they would go to Spotify and find your music that was officially released that was also monetized. Got it.
Yeah, and there was just this option, either I would take the entire revenue or they would keep the entire revenue. There wasn't any split model, and I don't think it was fair. Like I said before, they make an entire video, 15 minutes, they use 10 seconds of my music. Like, okay, so we have to find a solution. I'd rather have them use my music, credit me, than taking their entire revenue, because also all the big YouTubers would never then otherwise have used my music.
Right, right. So did you change that model at all? Do you, like, how are you monetize? Are you monetizing your music on YouTube other than just your channel, or do you just work directly with YouTube to monetize your channel?
Yeah, no, I didn't change the model.
Okay.
I could have changed it later on with new songs, but I really don't want to, because it's just I started it, so I don't feel like it. And of course, I wouldn't never change it backwards and start claiming all the videos that used my music.
Okay.
It's totally out of the question, of course.
So you're okay with money being left on the table because of that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are other situations where people made quite some money with my music where that bother me a little bit more. Like, for example, a remix I did for Diplo that wasn't paid at all. So my management back then brought me a remix and said, hey, you can do a remix for Diplo. He was like very hot at the already back then. Sure. I was like, cool, like, what do I get? They're like, yeah, you don't get anything. You can make a remix for Diplo, official remix. Said I, okay, cool. And later was licensed in a Coca-Cola commercial worldwide for two things where the entire, like, it wasn't like a small snippet, but the entire commercial built on my music. And, like, he got everything and I got zero because I didn't have any credits. I just gave away the rights. So this is more where I'm like, okay.
Yeah, right. There should have been some protections built into that deal. That's not... I hate to see that and hear that, and that also is not a very good reflection on Diplo. That seems like he's very much taking advantage of the collaborators.
Well, but I don't want to hate him here because it's probably, knowing how it works behind the scene, he wasn't like, yeah, let's take it from him. It's just his label, right? And I was a very up and coming remixer at the time, and they didn't plan to place in the Coca-Cola commercial, because that happened like 2 years later. And then they had the rights, so why would they give me something? So I'm...
Right. Yeah. Well, still, did you learn from that? No. I think that's not fair. I mean, plain and simple.
No, like how it turned out, it's not fair.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. And you know, like, yeah, they could say, well, you signed the agreement to do this for free as a promotional tool. So that, you know, that's on the extreme end. It's like, there should... you know, be protections in there where if there's a usage other than, you know, XYZ, other than YouTube only or something like that, then you earn 50%, 20%, something of whatever money is made. And I'm assuming that that's how some of your other deals worked, where you'd split the back end royalties from the remixes or productions that you'd do?
No, the remixes, they were all buyouts.
They're all buyouts. Okay.
With the other remixes, nothing big ever happened. I think remixes are such a commodity in a way, right? It's just the label. They release a song and then they're like, yeah, let's do a couple of remixes. So they look at some up-and-coming people who don't really have a big name often, and they just give them a chance. They pay a little money and they just throw it against the wall.
There's like got to be a... Yeah, it makes sense, but they're. I would encourage any producers or remixers listening to this right now, add in a stipulation to the contract that they cannot use it for sync, because that Coca-Cola commercial. I mean, I know what sync pays. That Coca-Cola commercial could have been in the hundreds of thousands of dollars,
definitely,
for an upfront sync fee, and you saw none of that. That, you know, there should be some protections in there. It was like, okay, you get to, you know, do the remix and it's going to be officially released with your name on it as a, you know, I still think that remixers should be paid something for that, or you share in the back end royalties. To me, it's like an either or. Either you do a buyout for $3,500 like Chris Brown, fine. Or you do, you know, you get royalties in the back end, or it's a combination of both. Some people can command and demand both of that. So either way, it's all a learning experience. I mean, getting back to YouTube, I do see, though, that there are some other, you know, channels on YouTube that are primarily built for listening to music. They're not like gamers that use 15 seconds of your music. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, there are some channels that have like the top 10, the Fat Rat songs as a full 2.5 hour video. And it's essentially just a playlist of all of your music that has millions of views. And I'm assuming you're not being paid from that because it's on their channel. I mean, how do you feel about that happening?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you could. It's probably not fair either. But yeah, it's hard. I would have to draw a line and say like, hey, this is allowed and this is not allowed. Yeah. But in the end, also, I'm very, very happy and grateful for everything I have. So I'm not in the situation where I need more money. So yeah, I mean, you could argue that it's probably when somebody, I know it's true. Like some people put together 20 of my songs, put it on YouTube and then have like 10 million plays on it. So it's probably quite some revenue that they're making from it.
But I do appreciate, I mean, you know, it's, I'm playing the devil's advocate and I'm, you know, I'm speaking from like what the industry heads would be saying and what all, you know, the music industry, the labels, the publishers, this is their argument essentially, is they want to wring out every penny from every corner of the internet they possibly can for all of their, you know, copyrights and stuff like that. And so it's just interesting to hear your perspective as an independent artist, that you have enough, that you've made enough, that you're grateful and you're happy with the revenue that you are generating from your music. That's a very un-American philosophy that you have. And you're not American, so it makes perfect sense. It's a, you know, but so let's, I'm curious to kind of get to, as you have evolved and maybe more professionalized your outfit, whatever that means to you. Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space. And let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder. And yeah, they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative. And they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Too Lost is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and you get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with Sound Exchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue. They have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out Too Lost. You can just go to TooLost.com, use the promo code Ari's Take for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think. You know, was there a routine or, a kind of a system that you used or to release music? You know, how frequently were you putting out music? Were there strategies that you're using to promote your music, or was it still just organically happening?
So, I mean, it evolved over time. And I want to reach people, of course. So it's kind of evolving at the moment because, so in the beginning, people discovered music on blogs. Then they discovered music on Tastemaker channels. Now they're discovering music on TikTok. So you got to be on TikTok and you got to make entertaining videos on TikTok. So that's what I'm actually getting started with right now. Like I just started with two videos, but they're performing quite well. And I gained, I think, like 40,000 new followers within the last few weeks. So it's moving there. Somewhere 340,000. It's definitely starting to
Oh, sorry. Continue.
I mean, so we're getting started there. And I must say, I'm lucky that I really enjoy making those videos. I really have like such a good time. It's basically as much fun as making music. So that is something that I'm starting now, because I think you need to be where people discover music. There's no way around it. It could be radio, but I never liked like aiming for radio because it's so much gatekeepers. I'd rather have the audience choose, put it on the internet and see, like have the audience choose what they like, because that has always worked for me, because you just make you make really good stuff. You don't have to please the gatekeepers. That's never been my business.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you about the video creations, because the what I've noticed from your TikTok channel, especially that video, the Aria Math Minecraft hand drum video that you did, which is hilarious and really well done, it takes some serious video editing chops. I'm curious, you know, and so is that a skill that you've recently taught yourself, or have you always been attracted to video editing?
No. So the editing, we brought one guy in from Sweden. He's been a friend for 3 years now, and he really helped another artist on TikTok. And then this artist said like, oh, he wants to take a break. And then said, hey, now if you would like to come to Cyprus and do something with me, I would be very happy about it. And he said, yeah. So now he's here, and now we're making videos.
Cool. Yeah, they're fun. And it's interesting, because this is a clear evolution that I've noticed from you, because all the other videos prior, like your that you had so much success on, like on YouTube, are just kind of visualizers, just you know, little animation and very basic visualizers, like a beautiful animated scene or something like that. And the song is playing behind it, which, you know, I think most people would just think, oh, let me just do that now on TikTok or something. But you're actually turning into a creator, and you're kind of creating stories along with these songs, and you've truly TikTokified the experience and the songs by creating videos in this way. And that's, you know, major props for kind of evolving that like that.
Yeah, thanks. It's just fun. I wouldn't do it if it wasn't fun. I'm in the lucky situation where I don't have to do those things if I don't want to, like talking about money again. But I really, really enjoy it. And I remember that when I grew up in the 90s, we had a VCR recorder, I think, or like a little camcorder. So once we had it, I think it was probably 14 years old, I was making videos all day, and I loved like being creative with it, like having like interesting cuts and like sort of special effects. You can do so many things with very basic setup, like having conversation with yourself, for example, or like exiting one room and then jumping out of the closet or stuff like that. Right. So just by doing like smart or clever cuts or whatever. And I spend so much time as a kid with that. And I'm rediscovering it, like all the craziness that you can do just because it's on video.
You know, and that's the right approach, is you have to be able to have fun with it. And, you know, I think where a lot of artists fall into these traps is they approach TikTok as kind of a responsibility and as kind of a chore. and they're like forced into doing it from their labels or management or just the pressures of the era that we're in within the industry that, you know, it's the most powerful promotional tool. It's where, you know, over a billion people are on this platform, and they feel like they need to be successful in this realm, but they don't like it. And it shows. And it shows that they're just kind of, you know, going through the motions, and it's not really connecting or working. Whereas, like, the way that you took it, it's clear that you're having a good time with it. And what I appreciated with it was, like, you're not – the videos, they don't look like anyone else's, because you combine your interests of, like, gaming. And so it's, like, for people that haven't seen this video, which I encourage everyone to go check it out – you know, I'm not a gamer, and so I actually had to look up, and I'm assuming that it's Minecraft is the game or something that you kind of are collaborating with. But it was cute. There was a character from Minecraft that was like interrupting you as you're playing on the hand drum, and then you're like, "Hey, can you like give me a minute?" And it's like, "Well, but let me freestyle." And so you like let the, you know, it, that's the story, is that you let the Minecraft character kind of freestyle, and so the whole song was kind of, that was your vocalist on it, which was super fun.
And then the rap is very, very dark.
Yeah.
Because it's a character that everybody, he's like those characters, they're called villagers. Like everybody walks into their houses, takes everything, because like free stuff that you can take. So everybody's like always taking everything from those guys. They're just villagers. And they're killing them and stuff. And that's what he raps about.
Wow. So did you create the song with that intention, with that idea? Or did you create the song for this video that you were making?
No, I created it for the video. But I wrote it in like, I don't know, like 5 minutes or something. We were just going crazy. And then we're like, oh, the villager should actually rap. And I was like, I wanted to go to bed. And like, oh, now we need the villager to rap. And I was just typing down like words. And I thought like, what would he rap about? And then it was like, it's really dark. It's like, oh, your friends get killed for fun. And everything's taken. They burn down your house. Da, 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 da. It's very intense. Yeah.
But it makes a lot. I mean, it makes sense, because you know, your audience would get into that and appreciate it, because it's the gamer community. Like it's almost like these inside jokes that you have. Whereas like I watch this, I don't understand it, but I'm not the target demographic and I'm not a gamer. But like I can appreciate it because you're talking directly to that audience, and that's kind of like, that's the beautiful thing about TikTok when done well. And not approached as like a chore or something, is like there are so many sub niches, like just so tiny communities or massive communities, but they're niche, you know, and like you can just find that. It's like the gamer community exists on TikTok, which I didn't even realize it exists. And I'm sure your TikTok feed looks very different from my TikTok feed. I've literally never seen a gamer pop up on my feed. I didn't know that existed, but of course it exists. It exists, you know, and so you find that community. And that's why, like, though that has that, you know, it makes a lot of sense that it is exploded right out of the gates like that. But also, you know, you're finding success on TikTok in the more traditional sense, where your songs, I've noticed hundreds of thousands of videos are using your music on TikTok now, similar to like how it worked on YouTube.
Yes. Also on YouTube Shorts. But this just happens. It just happened.
Okay, right.
So one thing was like 1.5 years ago, almost 2 years ago, was the outro song that probably most people who used TikTok at the time probably heard. It was like an outro for every situation. It was sort of initially picking up on this theme that like every outro on YouTube was using my music. So then people translated that into real life. And like a lot of people participated on it. Like Lil Nas X did something, some of the biggest YouTubers, and even DJs played the outro song.
Which song is it? Sorry. Which song
is it? It's called Xenogenesis. So X
Xenogenesis. Got it.
N-O Genesis. Xenogenesis. Yeah.
Got it. Fun. So that's great.
Yeah. But then also at the moment, it's like YouTube Shorts is blowing up like crazy. And it's like, I think it's in Asia, it's some videos about like planting bananas or something. They're all using the same song. They're using my song Origin, and they have like millions and millions and millions of plays. And it's Malaysian, and it's about planting bananas. And it's, yeah, I'm wow. looking at it. Okay, that's wild. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And so now, you know, I'm curious, what is that, other than just like, this is super fun and it's great to see, and the, you know, the promotion, the exposure, and your music is being used. You're an independent artist, so you get, you know, you're making all of the revenue from your music. Now I have to ask, you know, is this translating into revenue in any form? And if so, like, where are you seeing the revenue come from?
Yeah, so that's the great thing about TikTok, that it really translates into streams.
Okay.
For whatever reason.
Spotify, really Apple Music, yeah, we're talking?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. They're all, okay. Yeah, like, yeah. You can really see. So my song Xenogenesis, I think it was at 15,000 plays per day. And when this mm-hmm. outro trend happened, it wasn't really well connected, because it wasn't that much about the song. And usually the song wasn't correctly in, because the point of the trend was that people would play it on a device, like they would play it on the TV, or they would play it sure. on their phone. So it was never connected to the actual sound. So it would have been much better. But still, the song went from 15,000 plays up to, I think, 80,000, 100,000 plays every day. So it was like,
wow,
it really changed something. And then there are like smaller trends happening once in a while, or just a video going viral. And you can really see it directly. And it's even the other way around. So I look at the Spotify analytics and suddenly see something going up like 10,000 plays per day. And then mm-hmm. I know, okay, something happened again. I can look on TikTok and YouTube Shorts and see where it's coming from.
Mm. And you're not really, you don't have much to do with any of that, right? You're not kind of trying to push these trends, or are you?
No.
No, it just happens.
They usually happen. So what I'm doing now is like, sorry.
I'm laughing because like artists are desperate for viral moments like this, and they will spend so much money hiring marketing agencies to try to orchestrate and create and craft viral moments or anything to get people to use their songs in their videos, and hire influencers and creators. And there's full ecosystems built around trying to get this. And this just happens for you.
Yeah, I'm just incredibly lucky, probably. So what I have to say is, when the outro trend happened, we pushed it a little bit. So then when the trend was already going on, it was quite established, we pushed it further by hiring a couple of influencers who also then did the outro trend. I don't know if that
okay, so you did
something big, but that was the only time. Already had, like, it already started on its own.
Right on. Who do you use for distribution?
I use iGroove now. They're amazing.
iGroove. And what's their model? Like, do they take a commission? Do you pay them?
Yeah,
to
they take a split. They do okay. take a split, but they're definitely worth it, because a lot of them that tell you that you get 100%, they go through different companies that then take a share up front. So you got to be careful with those. So we see like the bottom line is even better than those that say they give you 100%, and they have great deals as well. And the most important thing is, we have people that we can talk to. Like, we have, and they, every artist, they onboard. So you have to have a certain size. You have to be somewhat established so you can work with them. It's not like everybody can just sign up there. But then we have a person that we can talk to. So whenever there's an issue, we can just reach out and like figure it out directly. Because with some other platforms, it was an complete, absolute disaster.
Yeah.
Absolute. So yeah, I'm going to talk about it right here. Like with TuneCore, oh my God. So we just asked them about the distribution in China. Say like, hey, are those songs distributed in China? We need to know, because they say it never arrived. So we get an email back. Oh yeah, we redistributed the songs to China, and we were like, wait, we just wanted to know if they were distributed, because now they messed up the entire process completely. Because we were claiming that it was distributed 2 years ago and was actually released, and we didn't get the revenue, so we needed to know if it was distributed. But then we sent an email, and they just redistributed it, which made it complete, like, blew up the entire process.
Oh man,
stuff like that. It's like, They're doing stuff that where we're like, oh, never reach out to the support, because they might like screw up your releases. So yeah,
it is something you've said, and it's encouraging to hear that from you, because You know, I think so many artists have experienced horror stories with their distributors. When you're dealing with your standard customer support reps that are just trying to, you know, go through customer support tickets and they have absolutely no relation and they don't know who you are. They're just like, oh, next customer support ticket. All right, let me close this ticket and let me check this off. And, you know, and there's just like no understanding that like there's millions of dollars on the line, theoretically, if they screw something up like that. And it's just like, well, close the ticket. Okay, next, let me go, you know.
And they're probably and just picking which of the standard responses they have is the most sufficient here. It's really, really dangerous. Like they can really do some serious damage.
Yeah. No, and that's a really good point. Is like even though there are some distributors out there that, like you said, you know, claim to take 0% commission. They may have sub distributors or something that take a commission, but above all, the percentage of the commission that's not as crucial as something like this, which they could be making mistakes that cost you money just because of they're inequipped to deal with artists at this level. And so even though theoretically, you know, a lot of these DIY distributors can cater to all artists, it's probably not recommended when you're at a level where you're making significant revenue to work with a distributor where you don't have a dedicated rep. Now, you know, to TuneCore or DistroKid or any of the Symphonic or you know, any of these other distributors that are DIY distributors, to their credit, they always do have personal artist reps and product managers internally, but you have to figure out who they are and get, you know, working with them. And usually they will reach out. I'm surprised TuneCore didn't reach out to you based on the numbers you were doing to like assign you a dedicated rep and all of that stuff. Because from what I've heard, the bigger artists, oftentimes they will get a dedicated rep, but you didn't. So you moved over to iGroove and that's great to hear that it's working out well for you there. Very cool.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Because they had like, it was a lot of streams going through them.
Yeah, but yeah. No, that's right. It's pure negligence that they didn't help you out with that. So that's too bad.
Because it wasn't based in the US. Maybe that was a reason. I don't know.
It doesn't matter. Shouldn't have happened. Yeah. So I read somewhere that you actually did work with a major label for a little time. I'm curious why and what that experience was like.
Oh, man. Why? Good question. I think, like, sort of... certainly one part was that I had a management, and they came to me with a couple of offers over time and said, like, hey, you should really try that. And I turned down, I think, a couple of major offers. I did turn down a lot of major offers in the beginning myself. And also from my then when I hired the management from them. And I don't know, at some point, I think I sort of gave up. And I thought, like, okay, cool, let's give it a try. It was a very, they had good reputations, I think. And I thought, like, hey, cool. Luckily, I already knew some of the traps, so I only did 10 songs with them.
So what label was this?
Universal Music.
Okay. So those songs are no longer on TikTok right now.
Yes, yeah. I think so exactly. So that was Universal Music and I only did 10 songs with them and and only a 7-year deal. But still, in my entire artist career, that was the worst decision of all that I ever did. Just,
why?
Just what from happened? A money side, because I just lost millions. It's just me.
Really? You just made them money and they didn't pay you the money?
I mean, they take such a big percentage and I can see how my independent releases perform and I can see how their release perform. I can see what they did. Even if they added 20% more streams, that would already be like, I don't think they added 20% of streams with the things they did. But even if I would take 20% off of what the songs are making but I would get 100% of the revenue, man, it's so much. Like so much.
What were they taking? What was your deal with them?
I think it was overall, it's different. It was different parts, like different territories, different stuff. But overall, you end up with it like 20-80 deal. So they take 80%. I get 20.
And you got 20%. And you said it was only a 7-year deal. Was this a licensing deal? It wasn't like they owned the songs in perpetuity. Got it. But they still took 80%. That's crazy. That's a lot. So you had those songs. Now, when was this? When did you work with them?
2016.
10 songs. Okay. And are those songs still, are they out? Are they still doing, I mean, are you seeing any revenue from them? Or are they released?
Yeah, I mean, of course I'm seeing great revenue from them. It's not that I'm not getting revenue. It's just the how much more I would have gotten if I just have kept them for myself and just self-released them. It's really crazy, the difference to see that.
Yeah. Interesting. And because, I mean, I have to ask you now, because this is the kind of the topic of the moment, because you were with Universal, have you noticed any of your songs on TikTok getting taken down or removed, or have you gotten caught up in that at all?
I haven't looked into it, I must say. I was so busy being creative, making videos. I usually don't really care about those details so much.
Yeah,
because I cannot do anything about it in this case.
Yeah. Do you have a publisher, an admin publisher, collecting your publishing royalties?
Not at the moment. I had one. We're just looking for a new one, actually, at the moment.
Okay. And are you signed up with royalty collection organizations in
Germany? Yeah, I'm with GEMA in Germany.
GEMA. Yeah. Okay. So they're collecting a bit of it. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, the reason I ask is because I actually just published an article on Variety yesterday talking about how a lot of independent artists got their music removed from TikTok because they were somehow affiliated with Universal in some way. Usually they had a co-writer that is signed to Universal Music Publishing Group, and they're starting to take it down. So there was an indie artist who said even the songs that he didn't co-write with a UMPG writer got taken down because Universal was casting this wide net. So I was like, well, you were at one point affiliated with UMG and some of your songs were affiliated. So I was curious if they were just saying, take down everything the Fat Rat has on TikTok, but which doesn't seem to be the case, which is good.
No, luckily not. I think we already warned them as well, because we already almost got into when it took them to court. We also currently doing an audit. So, yeah.
Good.
I
good for you.
I have nothing.
They know not to fuck with you.
Yeah, I have nothing against the people there, but they know if they would do that, we would immediately they had to find an agreement with me because they messed up some stuff, because directly hear from my lawyer.
Great.
So, we're directly it's straight talk. We're not like, hey, could you please? It's like, this changes really quick or it's getting expensive. So they're probably...
That's good. I mean, that's how you have to deal with these major corporations that have full legal teams. It's like, it's not about the nice people who work there, because there are very good, friendly, wonderful people that are good at their jobs who work at these major corporations. Absolutely. But at the end of the day, you're not signing a deal with those friendly people. You're signing a deal with a massive corporation and their legal team, and it's all in black and white. And the friendly people, their hands are tied, or they may get replaced tomorrow. And a lot of them just got let go anyways. So it's you have to approach a corporation for what it is. And that is it's a legal contractual relationship.
Exactly. And it's even the legal people are probably really nice, but you're dealing with a corporation. They're just employees. Yep. So it's never about them. Yep. I don't blame them. I would I think I would have a drink with any of them if I would see them at any event. It's really nothing personal. But with Universal as a corporation, I treat them, I think, the proper way. Or you have to treat them
as you absolutely have to. And yes, I'd have a drink with a lot of them too. However, the executives that are in charge of those policies, I'd have some words for them at our drinks. let me just say, because it's like they could change those policies. And I've talked to so many producers or session musicians or mixing engineers. That it's like pulling teeth for them to just get paid what they were contractually agreed to get paid to do a mixing session or an engineering session or whatever. And it's like you'd think with an organization that's making billions of dollars a year that they would fairly compensate the creatives that are helping them do what they need, that their entire business model is, instead of dragging their heels and, you know, making creatives and artists and producers and engineers chase them down for months on end to just get paid the little amount that they were going to get paid. And it's like, it's, yeah, the whole business model drives me insane.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have, this is a little bit of a tangent, but there's one thing that I once saw. I always remember it. So if you take, a piece of paper and you make a lot of squares, right? And you can simulate that in your computer. And some of the squares you make blue and some of the squares you make yellow, right? And you say, okay, let's define every square, every color tolerates a certain amount of different color around it. And you say like, okay, so I have eight squares around each square. So for each square, it's okay to have five other squares around it with a different color than its own, right? Can you follow? Right. So you have a ton of squares. Some are blue. Some are yellow. Mm-hmm. And so every square is either blue or yellow. So this is like to simulate tolerance. Okay. And now if your square says, oh, there are like more than five squares around me with a different color than my own square, then I'm going to change. So each square on its own is pretty tolerant, right? But if you play that through and you keep repeating it, you get a complete line. You have one side blue and one side yellow. So even though every square on its own is sort of tolerant, the system as a whole behaves sort of racist, if you will. So I think that always makes me think there are a couple of different other examples that sometimes a system behaves different than any of the actors actually wants it to behave. So, and that's also what I see with artists. I think the system as a whole can be very toxic for artists, but I think I would be careful with blaming specific people. Yeah, maybe on the executive level, but also I think their shoes probably don't have a lot of choices either. And it's also, for example, I think a lot of the reason, for example, why why artists end up in major deals, which are very detrimental to their career, is the managements. But then the managements, the way the deals are usually structured between an artist and the management, I would probably do the same thing, I must say, because it's very, it's very, very hard to manage an independent artist. It can backfire so hard when you're managing an independent artist, and it's so much easier to sign the artist to a major label and then just get it cut off the advance, and then you're sort of out because the label's taking over and you have your money safe, rather than managing an independent artist and rely and building them up over time. And then the revenue comes in very delayed. And then when you're having that artist build up over 2 years and finally the revenue really starts flowing, then you're already out of the game, right? So it's just the system, that the way it works can be sometimes very, very detrimental to artists' careers, but it's hard to really... we should be careful with blaming specific people, because sometimes just the system how it has grown and how it works can behave differently. Yeah,
that's great perspective. No, you're right, and it's really good insight. Do you have a manager currently?
Yes, my wife.
Oh, there you go. Fully of a trust baked in. Yeah,
yeah. So
I managed my wife's career too.
Sorry, can you say it again?
I manage my wife's career as well. She's an artist, and amazing. So keep it in the family. Yeah.
Because I think that's a way more sustainable model, is to see an artist's career as a startup, and if you have a manager that's fully on board. So because the thing is, as an artist, you have one manager, but ideally the manager only has one artist. I think the entire thing gets really complicated when an artist has one manager, but the manager has a couple of artists, which a lot of managers have to do, because you cannot just like connect that close to one artist.
Well, the business model is if they're making 15-20% of their gross revenue and the artist is making only, you know, $100,000 a year, maybe $200,000 a year, that means they're doing really well, at least at the start. You know, if you crunch those numbers, that's not a livable salary for that manager if they have to live on just the one client. So that's just the whole business model. But yeah, it makes sense.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But that's the reason why things get really complicated, I think, because it's the relationship is not equal in so many regards.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chris, this has been a really fascinating conversation. I appreciate, hearing your insight and perspective and your journey and your story and everything. And it's a real inspiration to see how you've evolved through the times and just kind of how you have made it work independently and you've gone through and learned so much, from working and seeing different sides of the industry. I have one final question that I ask everyone who comes on the show, and that is, what does it mean to you to make it in the new music business?
Good question. To make it? I think for me personally, it means to be able to fully focus on the art that I like, the music that I want to make, and I don't have to do other things on the side to sustain myself. I think as long as that is given, I'm very, very happy and very, very grateful for being in that situation, because I think that already means a lot.
Amazing. Chris, thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Today's episode was edited by Mikey Evans, with music by Brassroots District, and produced by all the great people at Ari's Take. This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over 1 million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.